This podcast is brought to you by On Track Studio.
This podcast addresses various mental health challenges, including topics such as suicide, addiction, eating disorders, depression, and anxiety. These discussions may be triggering for some individuals. If you or someone you know is struggling, please seek support from a mental health professional or a trusted individual in your life. Remember, you are not alone and help is available. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back, everyone, to Season 2 of Mind Your Head. My first guest is Shari Dawson. In this episode, Shari opens up about her inspiring journey after being rushed into emergency brain surgery and finding out that she has a condition called acromegaly. It is a rare hormonal disorder that affects the body's growth hormone production, leading to physical changes and health challenges. Shari's mission is to raise awareness about acromegaly and to offer hope and support for those who may be experiencing something similar. Shari, welcome to Mind Your Head.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Firstly, what's it like being back on the sunny coast? I know you made the move from Melbourne back home.
Yeah.
Is it to see the sun more regularly or?
And that's honestly what it is.
Is that what it was?
No, not really. It was to see the water every day and just to be around my family. Like I really missed being around my family, going through lockdown in Melbourne where I went through almost a year without being able to see anyone. So. It was just like something that I've been wanting to do for so long. And I sort of planted the seed to Chris like 7 years ago. I've just been watering that seed.
Every day.
And finally, one day he was like, let's do it. And I was like, what?
What do you reckon was the catalyst for him?
My diagnosis again. So being told that my tumour was back. And also that coincided with our last failed IVF cycle, and I think he could see that I was just like, this is too much for me right now, and I just like need to be around people. I just needed to be around my family.
Yeah. And you mentioned lockdown. How bad was that down in Melbourne? I've got some cousins down there, and obviously up here we had a few days where we couldn't do a couple of things, but like in general my life didn't change a whole lot. But I spoke to my cousins down in Melbourne and they were speechless. I had to like ask them how bad it was and they just sort of shook their heads and didn't actually like tell me. I could tell that it was really bad.
I mean, looking back at it, it is crazy what we had to go through. Like we couldn't, I mean, Chris's parents live 15 minutes down the road from us and we couldn't even see them because our 5 kilometer bubbles didn't cross. So we would have to meet them at this one park where there was like an overlap of our 5 kilometer bubbles. And I'm pretty sure we had to like drive over our little limit to get there, but then weave back around. And like, it was just insane.
So was the police patrolling all those?
How
heavily police was it?
Well, I mean, we also had
curfews
as well. So that was, they did patrol that. And like if you got pulled over, you did have to show them this piece of paper that said, I can be outside of my 5 kilometer zone. Like it's just insane. I felt like I was in, what's that movie, that show, The Handmaid's Tale.
I haven't watched it.
Oh, watch it.
But yeah,
it's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just like
borderline illegal, some of the things that was happening.
Yeah, it was crazy. And it was crazy.
Yeah, and it's strange how that was the only state that was doing that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I feel bad for all the people who really, really suffered. Like the people who didn't get to say goodbye to their loved ones. Like that sort of stuff. You'll never get that back.
Never. Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, it wasn't the worst time because I'd just had my first surgery and a second surgery. After my second surgery, I was in lockdown too. So I was just chilling at home anyways. So I wasn't missing out on anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I felt like I wasn't missing out on anything, but it was still tough. Like,
absolutely.
Not being able to see people and just do normal things. Like we couldn't go shopping together. I had to do the food shop. That was my like little outing.
It was the food shopping. And how long did it last?
Ages. Well, we were in and out.
It was in and out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think the longest one was like 8 months or something straight. Yeah.
The second one. Well, and my sister, she would come down to visit and then get stuck in Melbourne for months at a time. Like it happened to her twice. So the first time she came down after my first surgery, got stuck for months. The second time she came down for my engagement party got stuck for months.
Was she off it?
She was just like, I love you.
I'm not doing this.
But I'm never living with you and your husband ever again.
Oh, she?
No.
But she did.
But she's always at my house.
Yeah, yeah. And probably the last time I was down in Melbourne was probably when I saw you about, you know,
yeah,
8 years ago or seven
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah.
And look, we've known each other since we were sort of 15 or 16 years old. And yeah, the last time we sort of hung around each other, you probably didn't know this, but I was probably in the worst headspace that I've ever been in. Yeah, I was doing a lot of partying and a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. And I was obviously in a relationship at that point in time, but yeah, I was just in such a bad headspace where I didn't see an out at all. And there was definitely thoughts of ending my life. And I just thought I was alone at that point. Like, I just didn't think anyone was going through something similar or anyone could relate. And I just kept it a secret. I didn't talk to anyone about it. And I had no idea that you were also
going through
something similar.
Yeah.
Are you able to take me back to that period and share what was going on for you?
It's funny, isn't it, when we look back and we think we were both in the same place, doing a lot of the same things to mask how we were feeling. But we were probably just like partying right next to each other, thinking like the other person.
How good is this?
Like, we're having the best time, but inside we were both just really hurting. And it's hard knowing that. And knowing that we probably could have been like a really great support for each other, but it just wasn't something that either of us had the strength at the time to open up about. And for me, not many people knew that I was going through that. I mean, I think if anyone looked at my life at that stage, it looked like I was having the best time ever. I was living in Melbourne in this apartment across the road from Crown Casino. Had an amazing job working at marketing there, and I was just living the life. But deep down, I was really, really battling with a lot of different things. And at the time, none of it made sense to me. And now it obviously does, now that I have all these answers. But I was going through so many different things. Like, I mean, from that time and then perhaps maybe a couple of years earlier, I can't really remember the dates exactly, but I had so many different changes happening to my body, both physically and mentally, that just didn't make sense to me. And I put a lot of blame on myself for it. And I suffered in silence a lot because every time I went for help, I was told, well, it's just this. And that's kind of like something you can change, but I could never change anything. So I guess what I mean by that is things were happening that was like, one thing was my jaw started growing, which is really random. So my jaw started growing and my mouth started moving and I couldn't understand why that was happening. And I went to a dentist and she said to me, oh, well, you've just had your tonsils out recently and your tongue sits differently and then that's just how you were always meant to be. And I was like, okay, like, I guess so. Like, if that's what she said.
Yeah, she's a professional. I'll listen to that.
And then like things like my feet were getting bigger. And I was like, this is so weird. Like, why can I not go into a shoe store and just put on a pair of shoes? Like, I used to be obsessed with shoes. And then I hated it. And all of these things I used to love doing, I hated doing because, like, I couldn't fit into any clothes anymore because I just kept putting on this weight that I couldn't lose. And I couldn't understand why I was putting on weight. And I went to a doctor once and I said, I feel like I'm so full of fluid. Like, all of my rings don't fit my hands anymore. Like, my face is just so puffy. My ankles are so puffy. Like, I can't put my feet into shoes anymore. Like, my knees are really sore. Every time I play a game of netball, I can't walk for another day. So I had to, like, stop playing sport. And I was just in pain constantly. Like, something as simple as bending over to pick up something off the ground, I couldn't do. And so I was having all of these, like, this physical pain, which also was, like, mental pain as well, because I was like, what am I doing wrong? And I had all of this anxiety and I don't know, I couldn't tell you what it was about. Like, I just honestly thought I was just doing something so wrong and I just could not figure it out. And I remember this doctor saying to me, you're confusing fluid retention for weight gain. Well, and pretty much all your problems are because of your weight and you just need to lose weight. And she didn't believe me when I said, but I I'm not doing anything to put on weight. Like, yes, I go out and party, but so does everyone else, and they're not putting on weight like me. Like, I was like, I just can't. And then I was sort of made to feel like I was doing this to myself, and it just became this really, like, I just don't know how to explain it other than I did not know what was happening, and I didn't know how to fix things. And I would mask it by going out and getting wasted with my friends, because like that way I could just not think about it. In that moment, I didn't think about how much pain I was constantly in.
Do you ever think, I think about this sometimes, but do you ever think that, like, what if we just opened up to each other?
All the time.
How things would have been different or changed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually, since you asked me to come on this podcast, and because I did know that we were both going through that at the same time. And, I mean, I had inklings about what you were going through just from what, you know, maybe Beck or Ben had said to me. But, like, nothing. They didn't tell me much. But all I wanted to do was be like, oh, I feel this, like I'm going through this. And I wanted to help you even though I didn't know how to help myself. And I think that was my biggest fear, was like, if I talk to you, I can't help you because I'll be a hypocrite. Because I don't know how to fix what I'm going through, and here I am trying to open up to you, but then you realize you don't need to fix people.
No.
You just need to talk to them and, like, just, you know, share that pain and make someone feel less alone in what they're feeling.
Yeah.
By saying, like, I get what you're going through. I'm going through it too. Neither of us know how to fix it, but, like, you're not alone in what you're going through.
And I think that's the first stage of fixing it, is, like, not having the solution but saying, I feel you, or I'm going through something similar, or it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, like, for the whole premise of this podcast is to open up and to feel comfortable opening up to people and know that you're just not alone. Like, so after doing this first season, I've had so many people reach out from school, from my childhood, saying, oh my God, I was going through this, the same thing, or something happened to me similar, and I can't believe you, like, from the outside looking in, you look fine. And I would have never thought, you know, you were going through something like that. And I was like, I tried to hide it. Like, I tried to mask it. I tried to pretend like it was nothing.
And sometimes I feel like the people who are going through it the worst are the best at putting on
the face. Yeah, yeah.
I remember listening to your podcast where you spoke about your experience and bawling my eyes when you told me about how you ended up in hospital, because I had a very similar experience, but I didn't end up in hospital. But I had, you know, there was one night where everything was just too much for me. And I really haven't told many people this, so, gosh, I feel like it's hard to say it out loud. But, like, there was this one time and I didn't sleep. So another part of all these things that was happening to me was I wasn't sleeping. I would be lucky to get 2 hours of sleep a night. So I had these sleeping pills. And I remember one night just being like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm in so much pain physically and emotionally that I just don't care what happens to me. And I just was like, I'm just going to take all of these. And I actually just didn't care. And, like, that's scary. It's scary that you get to a point where you just don't care. And so I remember I did it, and I woke up the next day feeling even worse, obviously, but thankfully still alive. And that was when I was like, okay, I can't do this. Like, I called up my best friend Holly, and I sort of told her, and she was like, you're not living where you're going to live anymore. You're going to come move in with me. Like, let's just try work on this, because you can't keep going how you're going. And that was the first time I'd opened up to someone, for them to realize the extent of where I was at.
It's unfortunate sometimes as humans that we always wait till rock bottom for us to make that change. And I've read a little bit about it, that the sort of your current pain has to outweigh the fear of change, you know. And for me in particular, like I had to reach that rock bottom for me to realize and scare myself. And I still think of how lucky I am to still be here. And I think about the life that I've got now, and I'm like, fuck.
It could have been gone.
It could have been gone. You know, I could have caused so much pain to my family, my mum and dad. I could have not have met my fiancé now and then have the life that I have. And I never want someone to roll the dice on something like that just for them to sort of get scared enough so they can make that change. But yeah, thanks. Thanks for sharing that.
No, sorry, that got heavy real quick. I mean, what, 5 minutes in and I'm already crying.
That's fine.
I told you I'm very hormonal at the moment. I'm so sorry. So, after that moment, like, that was rock bottom in terms of me not telling anyone. And then I sort of became a little bit more open about it because I was too scared to ever get to that point again.
Yeah.
But my anxiety still hung around. And, like, the depression, perhaps not as heavy, still there, but that it was more that anxiety. I just had this constant fear of something that I just didn't know what was going to happen.
You talked about sort of different doctors misdiagnosing you. When were you finally diagnosed and what was sort of the catalyst for that?
So I was diagnosed in 2020, which is about 7 or 8 years after when I can think of my first initial symptoms, which really is quite a long time. But unfortunately, with rare disease and with my particular disease, it's quite common to have about a 7 or 8 year diagnosis. So what happened was, it was just a normal night. We had friends over at our house. We were around the fire, just drinking wine, just having a great time. And then everyone left and we went to bed, and I woke up the next day, or when I say the next day, maybe like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I felt like my head had exploded. And I should also say that within those last 7 or 8 years, up until this moment, I also had really bad migraines. So having a migraine was not uncommon for me. To have this feeling was not uncommon. The difference with this particular episode was that I was vomiting up blood straight away. Wow. So I'd get these migraines and I would vomit, and then what would happen? Like, it's sad that I actually had a routine. Like, I kind of knew. Chris and I would just like go into this routine of, okay, she's got a migraine. Chris calls the home doctor. The home doctor comes out to our house. He gives me a needle that stops me from vomiting. Then usually once I can stop vomiting, I can fall asleep and then my migraine will go.
Is that strange thinking about it now?
Oh.
How that, like, routine that is, but how not normal,
like,
that is.
Like, that's not normal,
no,
is it?
No, no.
Like, you've never done that before?
No. But, like, even the both of you were like, oh, this is just what happens.
Yeah, for neither of us to be alarmed by what was happening, because it was, yeah, like, it was just so normal for me to just have migraines. I had them for years and
years. To that extent,
yeah. Where, you know, I had ended up in hospital previously, and at that previous hospital trip years before, I'd had the CT scans of my brain and I had a lumbar puncture, and I was told everything was clear.
Really?
Everything was good. Yeah. And then, so this particular time, the doctor came and he saw me and he gave me the shot, and he was like, look, if she doesn't stop, you will need to take her into hospital because she'll become dehydrated and she'll need some fluids. So the next day, I was still vomiting and I was just in so much pain, and I was like, okay, let's just go into hospital. I hated going into hospital, especially because it was it was right before COVID. It was about 2 weeks before COVID got really bad, but we knew about it. Mm. So I was like, I don't really want to go somewhere where there's potentially COVID, because we didn't really know how bad COVID was. But anyways, I ended up going into hospital. They treated me with some IV fluids, and then they said, because of your history of migraines, we're just going to treat it like a bad migraine and we're going to send you home. But if this persists, then you can come back. And so the next 2 days, I just spent every single waking second in pain. Mm. And I would just try and find any means possible to, like, give myself some form of relief. So I would be in my bed, and then I'd get up and I'd have a really cold shower, and then, like, make it hot and then make it cold and make it hot.
That would feel good.
That would feel good. I'd go from being, like, really hot to really cold, really hot, and it would just shock me somehow. And I would, like, go lay down in another bed, and then I'd get up and move to another room, and I would just have to keep moving.
Getting different sensations or something.
Yeah, just to try anything, because I was like, I'm just in so much pain. And then it got to a point where I said to Chris, I cannot do this anymore. Like, I need to go back into hospital. And so I went back into hospital and they gave me something magical that made me feel a little bit better.
Morphine.
And so I was like, okay, well, I'm starting to feel a little bit better, but when is my eyesight going to improve? And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, I've got double vision. Like, I can't really see properly in my left eye. And they're like, why haven't you told us that? I'm like, look at my eye. Like, it's like popping. And so that finally prompted them to do an MRI of my brain. And that's when I was laying, I'll never forget the moment, I was laying in this, oh, sorry, before that, they gave me a lumbar puncture. Have you ever had one of those before?
No.
Worst.
What thing. Is it?
So they stick this massive needle in the back of your spine and you have to like lay there and this needle is like this long and they stick it into your spine and then they keep it in there while they like the spinal fluid like drips out of your spine and they test you for meningitis and things like that. And so my inflammation markers came back really high. So they originally diagnosed me with viral meningitis. So that meant that I was rushed off. Everyone around me had to be in full PPE. No one could touch me just in case they got infected. Gave me my own room, which wasn't bad. I mean, I'll take it.
The perks.
It's the little things.
Little
right?
things, yeah.
And so I was put in this room and then I think Chris had to do something. For whatever reason, he wasn't there and this doctor came in and, I mean, it was unreal. Like people just, doctors would come in and do these tests and then leave and another doctor would come in and do a test and leave and like all these sorts of things. And this one doctor finally came in and he was like, did they tell you? I was like, did they tell me what? And then he was like, you've got a mass, I can't remember. It was like you have a mass on your pituitary that has bled and the neurosurgeons at another hospital are reviewing your scans and we think you're going to need to go in for emergency brain surgery. And I was like, what? I have a what on my what and I need emergency brain surgery? Because I have no background in health, biology, nothing. Okay. So like firstly, a mass, what does that mean? Like
you're saying words to me that mean nothing.
And I couldn't say pituitary. Yeah. Like I didn't know what a pituitary was. And so I remember calling my dad and being like, Dad, I have something on my something in my brain and I'm probably going to need to go in for emergency brain surgery. And my dad was just like, what as well? Because he was like, what? Tell me what they said. I was like, I can't tell you what they said because I have no idea what it means. Mm-hmm. And so the doctors came back in. I was like, can you repeat what you just told me? Because I'm trying to tell my parents, but I don't actually understand what's happening to me. And so then they rushed me to another hospital for emergency brain surgery. And at that point, I was sat down and these neurosurgeons were looking at me and they said, has your mouth changed over the years? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, what about your hands? Like, do your rings not fit you anymore? And I was like, yes. And they're like, what about your feet? Like, do your shoes, have you gone up in size and shoe size? I was like, yeah. I was like, yes. But like, what does any of this have to do with my brain surgery I'm about to do?
Oh, well.
And like, we don't think you have viral meningitis. You're experiencing pituitary apoplexy, which means you have a tumor on your pituitary gland and that's bled. But this tumor is also causing you to have a really rare disease called acromegaly. And that acromegaly, it means your body's producing too much growth hormone. And like in that moment, it was just kind of like all these words are being thrown at me, but I was also kind of like, oh my God. It all finally makes sense. Like everything makes sense. Like I didn't know what acromegaly was. And like half the things that they told me, like I didn't really take it in. All I really took in was I finally have some answers. And then also at the time I had to be like, okay, I'm about to go in for brain surgery. So let's sort of focus on that at the moment.
Was that like a sense of relief? Because I'm sure you would have somewhat lost faith in the medical industry when you keep getting knocked back and telling that
everything's fine
or you're doing this or it's in your head or it's, well, it was in your head, but you kept getting knocked back and saying, this, you'll be fine. And when you got that, I know it's like one of the worst, you know, things anyone could say to you, but at the same time you're like,
oh. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. I was like, oh, like finally all of a sudden I realized nothing was my fault.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't doing this to myself. I wasn't the reason that all of these things were happening to me. It was just my body that was completely outside of my control. And so right before we went in for that surgery, I had to have another MRI. And I said to the radiologist, I said, I was here however many years ago because I came in with a with a migraine. And they did a scan and they told me everything was good. Can you bring up my scan again and just let me know, like, was it on there? Because at least then we'll have a time frame. Like, at least I'll know how long I've had this for. Because, like, when the neurosurgeons upstairs were asking me, like, when was the earliest time you think this? I was like, I don't know. Well, the earliest time I can remember is when me and the girls went to Europe and I was looking at this photo of me and Holly and my face looked really different. And I remember thinking that was the earliest time I noticed changes in my mouth.
And how long ago was that?
Well, we were 22 in Europe and I was 29 at this point, so 7 years. And so, and then that MRI must have been like 2 or 3 years later. And so she pulled it up and she said, look, it was on there, but it was missed.
Oh, wow.
So like if someone had have picked it up, like maybe 4 years earlier, then I wouldn't have had all of that, you know, pain and everything within the however many years it had been. But I was like, at least I know it was definitely there from that point in time. And it wasn't like just me thinking, because there were many points where I was thinking, am I making this up?
Yeah. You start doubting yourself, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. I'm like, is this normal? Like, does everyone else have really sore knees? And like, am I just being a baby about it? Like,
yeah.
But yeah, it just felt like, okay, I finally knew what was happening.
So what exactly is acromegaly? Is it, do you want to explain it to people? Yeah.
Yeah. So your pituitary gland, maybe we'll start there.
Yes.
Is, so it's this pea-sized gland that sits at the base of your brain and it's essentially the hormone control center for your body. So it produces a lot of hormones that have effect on all different parts of your body. So one of those being growth hormone, things like your cortisol, so your stress hormone.
Stress, yeah.
Things like your reproductive hormones, thyroid, and there's probably more that I've forgotten. Mm. But so my tumor causes my body to overproduce too much growth hormone, essentially. And so in children, it's considered gigantism. So people probably know the term gigantism. You know, Andre the Giant, Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yeah, yeah.
All of those people had gigantism. So they have my condition, but it started when they were a child. And so because my tumor developed after my growth plates closed, so I still had the enlarging of like my hands and my feet, but I didn't grow any taller. Whereas when you're a child,
you just keep growing.
But also it does make your soft tissue and your organs to grow. So I've got, you know, enlarged heart. Like, yeah, and I have a big heart. So I've got all these, so my organs are enlarged, which obviously has a lot of other comorbidities related to the disease. So when it's untreated, you've got things like risk of heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, like so many different things. And it can also lead to early death if not treated.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky to now sort of know what's happened and like be able to treat my disease. But, I should say I've gone through being told I've got a tumor. No, I don't. Yes, you do. No, you don't. Yes, you do.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so there's just, that's kind of what acromegaly is.
Is it irreversible? Can you change it? Is that the word, irreversible?
So you can't change the bone structure.
Yeah, that's for life.
That's for life.
And even the larging of the organs and everything, that's for life.
Yeah, okay. So that won't, but the things like the soft tissue growth. So my hands were just full of what I said was fluid.
Mm.
Like it just melted off me the second my growth hormone came down. So I remember Chris gave me this ring for Christmas 1 year and it was his great-great-grandmother's ring. And I could not fit it on my finger because I had so much fluid. And then the second I got out of hospital, I was like, oh, I'm going to see if this ring fits me. And it just like slid on in because within that week I was in hospital, I came back, honestly, no word of a lie, like 10 kilos lighter, if not a little bit more, just because it just all came
that quickly.
Off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how was the treatment process? Obviously, they removed the tumor.
Yeah. So they removed the tumor. I was told at that point that they think that they'd gotten everything. So my pituitary looked quite clear. But then, 6 months later, I had my follow-up scan and my follow-up bloods, and my blood showed that my growth hormone was still elevated. When I say growth hormone, I mean my IGF-1 level. So you test your IGF-1, not your growth hormone in your blood, because your growth hormone changes so much throughout the day. But your IGF-1 is a good indicator of your growth hormone production. So my IGF-1 was still quite high. Mm. And so they re-looked at my scan, and they saw that I had residual tumour in my cavernous sinus, which is kind of like this little pocket behind your eye, and it's considered an inoperable location because there's too many risky nerves and like your carotid artery and things like that in there.
Really?
So I was told I could either have radiation to get rid of the tumour cells or start medication, which was these monthly injections that you have to go and get done from a GP every month. And it will lower your growth hormone. And over time, it's also shown to reduce the tumor cells. So I started with the injections because at that time, I didn't really want to go down radiation because there's a lot of risks. And also, you know, I was 29 at the time, still hadn't had children. Children was something I wanted, but there was a risk of further damage to my pituitary, which I didn't know at this time, which I later found out that when I experienced pituitary apoplexy, so that's also a very rare thing within itself. So to have a pituitary tumour, I think 1 in 5 people have a pituitary tumour, but 1 in 1,000 have one of like clinical significance. So, but to actually have what I had where it bled was like this other rare thing, and then I had this other rare thing. And then so when my tumour bled or when they were doing the surgery, it damaged my actual pituitary and the function of some of my other hormones. So I didn't know at the time, but I also had lost all of my reproductive hormones. So I could no longer fall pregnant naturally. And that was one of the major risks one of the reasons I didn't go down radiation at the beginning was because I didn't want to risk losing more hormones.
Yeah.
I thought I'm better off just while my other hormones are intact, I'll just manage this one hormone that's, you know, going haywire. So I started the medication and, look, it did its job in that it reduced my growth hormone, but it also gave me a lot of side effects. So I was really unwell every time I had the injection. I was really nauseous. My hair was falling out in like clumps. My heart rate just plummeted. I would be sitting on the couch every night and I would just be taking these like really slow breaths because like I couldn't breathe, and every time I would get up I would be dizzy and I'd be puffed. So it just wasn't, I didn't have the greatest quality of life. Like I just didn't really respond well to them. So they kept sort of trying to reduce my dose while still manage the tumor, which was a bit tricky, but we kind of got there. And because all of that was happening, I was like, this just like, I got to a point where I was like, I just need to talk to someone else about this. Like I talk to medical professionals about it and that's all well and good and they tell me all these things, but I kind of want to talk to someone else who has been through what I've been through and who can tell me like what worked for them and what other things did they try and do I know everything? Because I really just only knew what people told me. And when you read things, sometimes I found, I mean, there's not heaps of literature out there on acromegaly, but also you do need to have a bit of a science brain to understand it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that just wasn't me. So I'd be like, Shane.
Is he in it, is he? What does he do?
He's a scientist.
Oh, is he? All right, actually, I do remember that.
Yeah. I know. He's smart.
Weird.
So I'd be like, can you explain this to me? And like, can you explain this to me? And can you do research and let me know what I need to know?
Mm. And dumb it down for me.
Yeah. And like, give it to me in plain English, please. Because I remember he came into hospital the next day and he was like, wow, Sha, like what you have is very, very rare.
Yeah.
And I was like, is it? And so then I reached out to the Australian Pituitary Foundation thinking like I can be connected with other women because I really wanted to know like what does my future look like? I've been told what I have to do right now, but I have no idea what this diagnosis means for the rest of my life. And so I reached out to the foundation and I asked them, you know, can you connect me with other women who have acromegaly, who have navigated the journey of becoming a mother and like what did that look like for them and things like that. And so they connected me with a few women. And one woman, she was in Melbourne. She was a little bit older than me and she was diagnosed later in life after she had her kids. But we had a very similar journey in that she had a tumour, she had surgery, then she had residual tumour in her cavernous sinus, was told it was inoperable.
Exactly the same.
And then because she's in the health industry, she was like, I'm not just going to take this as for what it is. So she went and spoke to a few other surgeons, I think 3 or 4 other surgeons. And then a few of them were like, yeah, I think so. Like, I think we might have success. And this one surgeon was like, I think I could get it out for you. Like, I think I've got a pretty good chance. So then she went, had a second surgery with him, and she's still in biochemical remission to this day.
Really?
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I will have a consult with this surgeon. And she was like, you need to call him. Like, she's like, call him right now or I will call him for you pretty much. She's so wonderful. She's just like, call him, tell him like what's going on and then just see what could happen. And so I told Chris and he's like, are you kidding? Like, let's definitely have this consultation. And I think at that point I had to really try temper my expectations and be like, okay, I'll go into this consultation with hope that, you know, we could potentially have a chance at removing it completely. But also, like, if he can't, he can't, and that's okay. Mm. But really deep down, I was like, please.
Please.
And so then I left that consultation with him saying, I think I've got a 70% chance of successfully removing and safely removing your tumour.
Wow. And then?
And then I, so within 2 weeks, I was booked in for my next surgery.
Yeah.
And that was, I think it was in between a lockdown or it was something. It was still peak COVID. So that was 2021.
So this is one behind your eye?
This is the one behind, yeah.
So how did it get in?
So both surgeries were through my nose.
Oh, through your nose. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they go through your nose.
You have a tiny nose.
See, they told me it's big.
Oh, does that?
Apparently, like, acromegaly means, like, it makes you this part wider.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but thank you.
You're like, another burn. I've got a big nose.
Trying to give me a nose job while you're doing the surgery.
What else can I get for free here?
So they go through your nose and then they cut out the bone that's sort of between, like, if you think of the side of your face, like, between your brain and, like, your face, skull thing.
Mm.
So they cut that out and then that's essentially where your pituitary gland is. So if you, like, went through straight here and straight here, that's where your pituitary is.
Yeah.
Because I think they used to go through your eye.
Yeah, well, that's what I was asking. Did your face look perfect?
Oh, thank you. so they go through the nose and then they, like, on my second surgery, they took the lining of the inside of my nose and create a little flap to sort of seal up that hole. Like, it's amazing. They're that's magical crazy. Humans, what they can do.
Yeah.
So when I knew that I could have that surgery, I was really, like, excited. So I think most people get really nervous about surgery, which I can completely understand. Yeah. Like, you're having brain surgery. It's a serious surgery. But for me, like, I think that I'd the first time I went through it, I didn't have a chance to be scared about it. And I was in so much pain that first time that I was like, do whatever you want. I don't care. Just, like, get me out of this pain. And so this second time, I think I was just really excited about the chance of perhaps, like, living a normal life again.
Mm. And that 70% chance sounded like 99%, didn't it?
100%. Yeah. And, like, in my mind, it's just what I do and it's what I did with that first surgery. I went in thinking nothing bad is going to happen to me. They read me all the risks. They told me everything that could happen. And I was like, it's not going to happen. Like, I just wheeled in. I remember being wheeled into that surgery and thinking everything is going to be okay. Everything is going to be fine. I mean, it was really hard for me to look back at Chris, who, like, up until that moment was so good, and then he just, like, broke down.
Did he?
When, like, he had to, like, say goodbye to me because they didn't know what I was going to be like when they saw me next. So it was hard to put him through that again, especially because after that first surgery, they said to him it was going to take however many hours. And that he could expect a call in, like, 4 or 5 hours or something. And so he's like, I didn't know what to do. So I just went home and I started cleaning the house. It was like, because I couldn't sleep. And my surgery was at midnight. He's like, I couldn't sleep. I didn't know what to do. I just like was up cleaning the house. And he goes, and then a couple hours later, I got a phone call. And he thought, shit, like I'm not supposed to be getting a call for another 2 hours. Like, why are they calling me so early?
Something's happened. Yeah.
And he's like, it was the hardest phone call for me to answer because he was just mentally preparing himself for the worst. And thankfully, the surgeon was like, everything went well. Everything's all good. And I was like, thank God.
How do you think it affected Chris? I know. If like we're talking about your story and that sort of thing, but it makes me wonder, like, if something was happening like that to Jordan, I would have to try to stay as strong as I can for Jordan, but at the same time, like, it would be affecting Chris so much, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Seeing you go through all that pain and then, especially being your partner, like, not being able to fix it, like, and as a man in the relationship, your natural instinct is just trying to fix whatever's going on and get rid of the pain. And have you had a chat to him about?
I have. I think he is just the type of person where he's got the most peaceful, calm energy, and that he truly makes you feel like everything's going to be okay. And so it was really hard for me watching him. Like, he was fine. Like, he really was such a rock that whole time, like, in the hospital. He came in the back of the ambulance with me to go for the second place for the surgery. And, like, we were laughing and things. Like, I know, weird. We probably shouldn't have been, but we were like, how fun is this? Like, we were like,
never been in the back before.
That's what he said. He goes, I've never been in the back. So the guy was like, strap on in. And so they strapped him in the bed next to me, and we're both strapped in these beds, like, watching all the lights at midnight going through Melbourne. And, like, so we kind of made the most of.
I think that's beautiful, finding humour in sad situations.
Yeah. You know? And so I think, I mean, I can't imagine how it would be. I do think it's easier being me than it would have been being him.
Yeah.
Because I knew how I was feeling and I knew I was okay. But it's hard, like you said, being someone that you want to care for them and you want to make them, you know, feel like everything and fix things, and you can't, and it's so outside of your control.
You feel helpless. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he's like struggled with it in that he's just had to learn to things are outside of his control, but the things he can control, he's really good at doing that. And he's just really good at being calm and so supportive. And even all of the anxiety and things that he had to put up with in the lead up to my diagnosis, and all of the pain and all of my meltdowns and everything. And then even post diagnosis and after, you know, like I said, I lost my reproductive hormone. So at 29, I went through the symptoms of menopause.
Wow.
And so he had to put up with that. And we were actually laughing about it the other day because I was like, I was fine, wasn't I? He's like, and I was like, no, tell me the truth. Like, how was I?
I was fine, wasn't I?
I was like, was I bad? Like, was I a bit crazy? And he just said, look, you had your moments. And I was like, why did you, you know, you never made me feel like that. And he goes, but it wasn't your fault. He's like, it wasn't your fault that you were feeling how you're feeling. Like, you had all of these things going through your body and, like, hormones. And he's like, you've been through so much. None of it's your fault. Like, I'm not going to make you feel bad for it.
Yeah.
I was like, God, you're a sweet, sweet angel.
An angel. And by this stage, it's been, you know, it feels like it's been, you know, almost a decade of hospital visits and 8 or 9 years or something up to this point. And, like, I listened to your story and it's so easy to be consumed by your current reality of pain and suffering that, you know, you can go down that path of blaming people, blaming things, like, this is why it's happened. And, like, I know that feeling. I've been in situations where, you know, just nothing compared to yours, but if I've been injured on the footy field, I've been out for months and or something's happened and I can't leave the house and I get really down and sort of almost play the victim role. What was the turning point for you and for you to accept what has happened? I can't change anything, but I can change how I react to it and going forward with my life. Was there a turning point?
I think as soon as I was diagnosed and I realized that everything I'd felt up until that moment, none of it was my fault, I then realized I can really control things moving forward. And I've realized I can't control what my body's going to do because I have, you know, I had that second surgery. I was in biochemical remission for 1.5 years And then I found out earlier this year that my tumour's back. So these sorts of things happen, and the whole time I've been really positive and really like, you know, everything is fine, and bad things still keep happening.
Mm.
But like you said, I can't control what's happening to me. I can only control how I respond to them, and that is just how I live my life now. And since I don't have the anxiety and the depression that I had from that moment, it just went, and I can really control how I feel about things, and I can control things like moving to Queensland to make me feel happy, things like making sure I go see the water every single day, because in the lead up to that second surgery, I truly thought I was going to come out blind, you know. So I think about the things and how I want to be and who I want to be, and I just don't let myself get caught up in the what's actually happened to me. And, you know, I never think why me, because I think why not me?
Mm.
You know, why I'm not any more special than the next person. Like if I can get, like I would actually rather get it than anyone else have it, because I know I can handle it, and I know I can handle everything moving forward. I just try and think like, I just don't let myself get overwhelmed by things, and I just think about, like, I still have such a beautiful life regardless of everything that's happened to me. And if not, I probably have a better life because it's completely changed my outlook.
Well, that's my other question is, how has it changed your outlook? You mentioned just then that going to the water means a lot to you. Has your priorities changed a lot since this diagnosis?
Absolutely. Everything in my life has changed. I used to be so, you know, career-driven, and everything I did, like, I needed to have that career. And don't get me wrong, I have a wonderful job. Like, I've actually probably got my dream job at the moment. But it's fueled by passion and commitment to a cause that's so close to my heart, not fueled by I want to make millions of dollars and all of this money.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that just don't concern me anymore. Things like how I look just doesn't concern me anymore. I just want to do things that make me feel really good and feel really happy, and everything I do now is based around that.
That's interesting. You said that about how you look, and you mentioned earlier that it's sort of your physical appearance has changed a little bit. Something that I do want to bring up is, I guess, body image in today's society. I think it's just more scrutinized than ever before, and I think the influence of social media is just, it's corrupting people's perception of what the perfect body image is, and people's confidence with their own body and what they look like and how do they fit in and be popular and be accepted, I think. And I don't think I've ever sort of talked about this publicly, but I've been through my own body image issues when I've been playing rugby my whole life, and every team since I was seven, every team that I was in, I was always the skinny kid, always. And
you have always been pretty skinny.
Oh,
I'm joking.
But it's like, for me, it built in insecurities in myself because I felt inferior to got men that were bigger than me or had more muscles. Or that's just how I felt when I was, you know, going through that puberty and going through early teenager. And all I wanted to do was put on weight, just get big. So I just feel like more of a man or more accepted. And then also coaches telling me, listen, you're good, but you're too skinny, so we can't pick you. And I'm like,
yeah, that's so
fuck.
Because you're trying to put on
I'm trying,
weight.
Yeah. And, yeah. And how I felt when someone told me, oh, you're so skinny, it felt like what someone would say to an obese person, you're so fat. It had the same effect.
Yeah.
And when people said it like, oh, skinny's good, like why is that a bad thing? And I'm like, well, the insecurities I have because of that doesn't feel like it's a compliment.
No.
You know,
no.
I'm
You
know, and I always try to, you know, do my hardest to try to put on weight, and it really it got to a point where I had to sort of start accepting myself for who I am and actually start loving myself and not comparing myself to other people or all the stuff you see in social media, like what girls like, what the perfect body that girls like and that sort of thing. Has this diagnosis for you created insecurities in yourself?
It did when I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
So before I was diagnosed and when I was putting on so much weight, you know, I used to hate coming back to the coast because I knew I looked so different to when I left the coast. And I knew that when I ran into people, they would probably think, oh, Shari's put on a few kilos.
Mm.
And like I hated seeing people that I hadn't seen for a really long time. And so I had a lot of insecurities in that regard. And, you know, the physical changes to my body, sometimes that's really hard to swallow, you know, and it's really confusing and it's a really bizarre thing to happen to someone, to look so different to what I used to look like. And, you know, I can say to you, if I sat here right now and I closed my eyes and I tried to envision what I look like right now, I can't do it. Because I actually don't know in my mind what I look like, because I see parts of before I was diagnosed to being undiagnosed to now diagnosed and it being controlled. Like there's so many physical changes that have happened to my body. But when I think about actual body image and things like that, because of everything I've been through and everything my body has been through, like going through 2 brain surgeries, going through years of being on and off, you know, medication that I rely on to live a healthy life, and also now going through my 5th round of IVF, like my body has been through so much that how it looks to me isn't as important as what it's doing to keep me alive. Mm-hmm. And so now when I think about people who are really concerned with how they look, I just want to say your body works and you're healthy and you don't realize how much more important that is until your health is taken away from you.
Exactly. You just answered 5 questions. Were you looking at that?
I can't see, I swear. My eye's still a little bit weird.
Moving on.
Moving on then.
Well, one of the questions was, how has the support of your husband impacted your recovery?
Oh, I couldn't have gone through it without him. Like having his support, like I said, he just makes me feel like everything's going to be okay. He always validates how I feel. He never makes me feel like anything is unreasonable or like, and he's there whenever I need him. He's at every appointment. I just couldn't ask for anything more from him, really. Mm. And like, I just feel so lucky that I have him, because it is a very isolating journey. And even though, you know, there are points when you feel like no one understands what you're going through, like he'll never truly understand, but he's got his own view on it and I won't ever understand what he's going through.
Yeah, exactly. You've mentioned it a few times that you're going through IVF, and I think you've been through enough. But this IVF treatment, everyone that I've sort of spoken to about it, it's never an easy one.
Yeah. Look, it's not.
What's been your experiences so far?
It's hard. I'm one of those weird people that get really excited for each round. So, I know.
You're ultra positive. I love it.
I just get, like, to me, it's just I've got a chance, you know. Mm. I feel so grateful that I can do it because a lot of people can't do it. And I'm really grateful that I have the chance to keep trying and that I have the will to keep trying. I mean, don't get me wrong, it is like a grueling process and it's all about these little, you know, milestones within IVF. You've got to grow your follicles, then they've got to become eggs, and then those eggs have to be mature, and then those mature eggs have to fertilize, and then those fertilized eggs have to become embryos. And like, it's never simple, it's never easy, and it's really, 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 really hard. But I constantly think of like that end goal, like holding a baby in my arms, and I just think it'll all be worth it.
Do you think that you're so much more resilient now because of like diagnosis and then heading into IVF, just your levels of positivity, it's just helping you during this process?
Yeah, for sure. I think I can just take so much now because I feel like I've heard some of the worst news I can hear. And being, like I said, I've been told, you've got a tumour. No, you don't. Now you do again. No, you don't. Now you do. Like, I've been told so many things and I've experienced so many things now that I just think, throw it at me. Like, I can take
Bring
it.
Bring it on.
Yeah, so after my fourth round, they were like, oh, and also you have endometriosis. And I was like, of course I do.
What's that?
Endometriosis. Okay. It's like a it's got to do with your ovaries, on like the outside of your ovaries, and it affects the quality of eggs, and like a lot of women have it.
So not only has this diagnosis affected you having kids,
I also have endometriosis.
That's also going to affect you having kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So when they told me that, I think they were shocked how unshocked I was.
Yeah.
Because I was like, of course I do.
Do you think that's affected your levels of emotion?
The
amount of negative news.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I said to Samantha yesterday, I caught up with her and I was just sort of saying how sometimes I think I'm a bit numb to things. But it's not because I don't feel. I definitely feel things, but I don't think I feel things as much as other people anymore.
It's like your tolerance is like up here.
Yeah.
So like when you get sort of news that some might shock other people, for you it's just like another Tuesday.
Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm highly, like, I cry all the time, but, like, mainly about happy things.
I do?
Yeah, like, it will take, like, I'll watch The Voice and hear a story and I'll cry about it.
That's what they want to hear, isn't it?
Like, I cry about lots of things. Yeah. Like, I feel those emotions, but I don't necessarily, I'll never feel really sad about myself often, because I think about all the wonderful things I do have. Like, and honestly, I think to myself every day, I feel so lucky. Like, I feel lucky to have a husband who loves me as much as he does, to have such beautiful family, to live in a place where it just makes me so happy, like to have my dream job. All these things, I'm like, I can't really complain. Like, life has still been very good to me.
Do you ever struggle accepting support from people?
Yeah. Sometimes. It depends what the support is.
I know that you mentioned yesterday, I think I saw you, was like you never want sympathy from people and people feeling sorry for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though I feel the same thing, but it's them coming from a
place of love.
A place of love.
Yeah.
Showing some sort of support.
Yeah.
Because I get really defensive. when I was sort of going through it, I never wanted people to treat me differently.
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason why I didn't tell anyone. 100%. Because as soon as I tell someone, it's their natural reaction of a friend or of a family member to go, oh, righto, well, how can we do this? And exactly. I'm like, don't do anything.
I'm fine. I've got this. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you still struggle with that a little bit?
No, like I'm a lot more open to support. Mm. And I love it when people do ask me questions about my condition or do check in on how things are. And, you know, I've got a lot of people, a lot of our friends and I were going through IVF and they're always like, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but just want to know, like, we're thinking of you.
It's always a taboo thing to talk about, isn't it?
And I'm like, no, go for it. Ask me. Like, I'm such an open book and thank you. Like, thank you for checking in on me because, like, I think sometimes people go the other way and they don't know what to do or they don't know what to say and then they just, like, completely ignore it and it's like, then it's more
awkward because you know and I know that you know.
So, yeah, I think I am open to support, but I still probably struggle with that whole sympathy.
Yeah.
I never want sympathy from people, but I am open to empathy.
So life back on the Sunshine Coast, how does life look for you now?
So life for me is a lot of family time. So see my parents probably more than most people want to see theirs, but I love it.
My mum and dad just retired.
Yeah.
They moved back to the Sunny Coast
yesterday.
They're back. So they left for 10 years
and I had a
social media relationship with my mum and dad. And now
just sending each other memes?
Yeah. Like. Well, not to that point. Okay. I'll be weird if mum knew what memes were. Yeah. Actually, she's done that before, but silly ones. But I've seen my mum twice in 2 days, whereas I saw my mum once every year.
Yeah.
And after the second day, I'm like, oh, I'm going home, mum.
Yeah, sorry, mum.
this is too much. Maybe we've got to build up to this.
Yeah, we're tapping out here, but we'll, yeah.
But I can relate to that because when I see my mum and dad, when I used to see them once a year, you really noticed how old they're getting. And when you're a kid, you just think your mum and dad are going to be around forever. You think that nothing's going to happen to them. They'll look the same forever. And their journey over in the mines in WA has really showed me that over the years they've sort of, the both of them have got grey hair now. You know, they're not moving how they used to move. They're still athletes. But it's really showed me that, like, how fragile life is.
Yeah.
And
you've got to...
It's made me realise, and I've never thought about this, which is weird because everyone's going to go through it, but I've never actually thought my mum and dad are going to die one day.
I that think thought, about it all the time.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I think about it more now just because I've seen them age.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, fuck, one day I'm going to actually have to say goodbye to them.
Yeah.
And I've never thought about that, even though everyone has to go through that
yeah.
eventually. And it's really, like, changed my perspective and, like, not how much longer have they got to live. It's more so how many times do I get to see them. So in, like, 10 years, I saw them 10 times.
Yeah, I know.
Which is silly.
It's just not enough.
It's not enough, yeah. is it?
Yeah. No, I actually think about it a lot, which is probably weirder. But that's why I always want to see them all the time, because I know that one day they're not going to be there. And I know that, you know, my dad and I talk to each other on the phone once a day, if not twice a day. And then I see my mum almost every other day. And I know that that's a lot. But one day I'm not going to be able to pick up the phone and call him. Or vice versa. I thought he wasn't going to be able to call me.
Mm.
So, yeah, you just got to just love your parents. Oh, gosh, this is one topic that really gets me.
Why is that?
I just love them so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how, like, you only sort of start appreciating everything your parents do, or even from my perspective, that you start really appreciating and noticing all the effort and sacrifice your parents have done for you. Only wait till you get older.
Yeah.
And you start actually providing for yourself and your family. You've got a partner and a family and stuff like that. You realize, fuck, how did they do this back in the...
I know.
Back in the 80s and 90s.
How did they make it look like it was easy. So easy?
It was so fun. I had the funnest childhood.
Right?
And then, like, I was getting, like, my mum and dad were buying us Christmas presents and birthday presents, and they realised that we were having more fun in cardboard boxes. Mm. So they would just get an empty cardboard box.
And wrap it.
And wrap it. And I was thinking, like, on their wages, raising three boys.
Yeah, how do they do it?
How did they make that work? Paying off a mortgage, feeding three boys, putting everyone through school.
And you don't even think about that, though.
You don't think about it.
You don't ever think that, how do they...
And then save. Like, how did they even save it all to go on? We went camping every weekend.
Yeah.
To Stradbroke Island.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how did you guys make that work?
I know. I guess it makes you realize, though, no matter what situation in, you always make life work.
Yeah. 100%.
Like, and that's what I've realized is, like, no matter what you're doing, you just somehow make it work.
Mm. Yeah. So where are you at now with your
treatment
and your current health condition at the moment?
So, like I said, I found out in January that my tumor is back, and it's at a state where it's considered, like, discord. So my IGF-1 is high, or it sort of dips in and out of being in normal range, and my growth hormone is always high. Yeah.
Is it the tumour on your pituitary gland, or is it the tumour that was behind your eye?
Well, they don't know. They can't actually find the tumour on an MRI, but they can...
Oh, know by the levels that it's back.
They can know by my levels.
Oh,
so we've just sort of got to keep having scans to see if it grows and that we can find it. But still, I need to treat it. Because I can't have high IGF, like, prolonged or sustained high IGF-1 levels. But because I'm doing IVF, I kind of need my growth hormone to have a child. And so, yes, you can be on medical treatment. Well, no, you can't do radiation for at least 6 months after. So you can't do IVF for at least 6 months after radiation. But I could go on the medical treatment, but it's probably best that I don't. To have a better success at falling pregnant. So I'm at this point at the moment where I'm actually not controlled. So I do have high levels of growth hormone, and I am starting to get some of the symptoms again.
Wow.
So things like my fluidy hands and, like, being really tired. So fatigue is a big symptom. So that's something that I'm managing. But I'm also just thinking I need to, my goal, like, this is just how my brain works. I can compartmentalize things pretty well. And right now my goal is to try and fall pregnant.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll fall pregnant soon. We'll see, but hopefully we do. And then once that happens, then I have to decide, do I want to go back on medication and be on that medication that was making me sick for the rest of my life?
Really?
Or because surgery is no longer an option because they can't see it on an MRI, so they can't, they don't want to go back into the cavernous sinus. One, it is considered an inoperable location for a reason, and we got lucky going in that second time.
You don't want to go again, yeah.
So you don't want to go again. So at this point in time, surgery is no longer an option. Who knows? Maybe 1 year it might grow big and they can find it and get it, but I don't know. At this stage, they can't. And so the other option is radiation, but there are a lot of risks involved with radiation, and one of that is being further damage to my pituitary and further loss of hormones. And at the moment, I've lost all my reproductive hormones, but I've got, you know, some really crucial hormones that are still intact, so my thyroid, my cortisol. And so I think, you know, am I best just to try and manage the one hormone that's sort of going out of whack at the moment? So I think that's where I'll go, but I really don't know what I'm going to choose to do. Like, it's something that I've got to sort of sit down with Chris, and we've got to, like, the idea of radiation, you know, there's a part of it that thinks this could be great because it could mean I'm in remission and I don't need to take this monthly injection. Because there's other things other than just taking an injection, it restricts you. You can't just go for a 6 week holiday to Europe or things like that. You can't, because I have to be, you know, somewhere where I can get this injection every 4 weeks. Yeah. And also, I don't feel like traveling a lot of the time, or I don't feel like doing much because I feel quite unwell with it. So, yeah, so I've got to kind of decide what to do. But at the moment, that's just parked until hopefully we can...
Yeah, fall pregnant.
Fall pregnant. Mm. But, I mean, there are so many things that are happening. Like in the States, there's a new drug for acromegaly that's looking like it's going to go to market in the next couple of years in America. Yeah. I don't know if it will come across here or when, but it's a tablet that you can take every day. So
I guess that's promising and somewhat exciting that there's so many medical advances every year.
And that's what I'm relying on.
Yeah, I bet you
are. I'm relying on science and technology.
Yeah, that's amazing. I do just want to say to you that it's been really beautiful connecting with you again. You haven't changed one bit to me at all. You're still that same beautiful girl that I met when I was 15 years old. You're still this ball of energy and love. And yeah, when I ran into you at the markets, I was just like, fuck, Shari hasn't changed.
Oh,
but in the most positive way.
Yeah, thank you.
You haven't changed one bit.
Well,
and I love that.
Well, that feels really nice because I feel like I've changed so much, so it's actually kind of nice to hear.
Well, getting to know you now, and I'm just like, the changes you have made, you seem like you're so resilient with everything you've gone through and the outlook you have on life. There's nothing that I doubt that you can't get past.
Thank you.
Do you want to say anything else before we get into this?
No, thank you so much for having me.
That's all right. So I have a closing tradition of the podcast where I get a loved one, a family member, a close friend. They send in questions for the guest. We've got two questions for you. We've got three questions, two from one person.
Oh.
Hey, Shah. I've watched you throughout your journey. Always stay positive and keep high spirits. My question to you is, what advice would you give someone who's been diagnosed with a chronic condition on how they can also stay positive?
Oh, that's a good question, Christophilus. My advice, I think, to someone with a chronic condition, or really just, I guess, it doesn't even need to be a chronic condition. It can just be anything in life that's like really tough, is it would probably just be, you know, one foot in front of the other. Just one foot in front of the other and then just day by day. Because I think sometimes when you think about everything that you might have to go through or everything that you've been through, it can be really, really overwhelming and all too much. And that's when it becomes, I think, a little bit too much. But just like, yeah, that one foot in front of the other. And also just take the little wins and have a laugh when you can. And it's okay to laugh even when things are really shit. Like, it's okay to smile and think about the good things even when things don't feel good. Like, just take all the little wins. And then, yeah, just day by day.
Love that. Did he say Chris?
Sorry, that's from my beautiful husband.
What's his name?
Chris. Or I call him Christophilus.
Yeah, I heard that. I wasn't going to repeat it.
I know, and he's the whitest person ever, but I call him Christophilus.
These next two are from Sammy.
Two from Samantha. Okay.
Hey, Shazzy. What daily rituals or positive habits have you put in place since you were going through your tough times that help keep you grounded?
Oh, that's a good question, Samantha. For me, it's been, like I said, walking to the beach, seeing the water every day, and not just seeing it but taking it in and just really thinking, gosh, I'm so lucky that I can do this. So for me, it is a lot of moving for me. So however that means for anyone else, for me, it's doing my walks, doing my Pilates. Yeah, it honestly, the water calms me.
Does it?
It just makes me feel so good. If we can, Chris and I, if we can go and have a swim before work every day, we do.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Next one.
During your toughest times, were there any self-help books or podcasts that come to mind that help pull you back into a positive mindset, or any that would be useful for anyone else going through the same thing?
Mind your head.
I've got to say, I do love your podcast, Elle, and I have listened to every episode.
Have you really?
I have. I'm a supporter.
Oh,
I have,
nice.
Because when I heard you were doing it, I was like, good on you. I was so proud, even though I know we haven't spoken to each other in like 7 years. I was like, I'm just so proud of like how far you've come and that you're not doing anything about it. And I think, you know, making change however we can is amazing. Yeah. That's why I chose to do the job I'm doing, because I'm doing everything I can to raise awareness about my condition and conditions related to my condition. And I think for you to do something like this is really amazing and share people's stories. And I've learned so much about so many people who I was very close with for a long time that I didn't know about. So, yeah, this is a great one. Mind your head.
Recommend.
Highly recommend. Click subscribe. Is it that
thing? Yeah, say it. Whatever.
I don't know about self-help books or, I mean, I'm sure I read things and listened to things, but for me it was getting out of my head that helped me.
How did you do that?
Walks,
yeah.
So when we're in Melbourne, we lived not far from this creek that had a good 5K walk. And I did that every single day after I got diagnosed, even though I was told to sit at home and do nothing. I was like, I can't. I just walked, and I just, like, a lot of the time I wouldn't listen to anything, because I think we consume so much on the daily. You know, we're constantly consuming. If it's not social media, we're in the car, we're listening to something, we're at home, we're watching something, like, we're just constantly, constantly consuming, and I just wanted to stop consuming and actually be alone with my thoughts, because when I was anxious, that's when I would be alone with my thoughts, and that's, I'm not consuming anything and I'm actually thinking about all the things. I'm hearing myself for the first time all day because I haven't had a chance to do that.
Yeah, because you haven't been distracted, or it's like that avoidant thing where you're just like, I saw something that people's worst fears, and it was like spending 10 minutes alone in your room, in a room by yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like that too.
Yeah.
Now I absolutely love silence.
Yeah.
I love it.
Same.
I love where my sort of brain wanders, and it's in a positive way, not so much like I used to think a lot about the past and a lot of decisions that I made, and a lot of, you could say probably regrets, and like, you know how you get, if you get drunk one night, and then the next morning you get that cringe. You're like, oh, why did I say that? I used to have that about my life.
Oh.
I used to think about certain moments in my life in my 20s. And I used to think about it and get that cringe from 6, 7, 8 years ago. From years ago. And I used to still make me cringe. And then I still sometimes catch myself, like, I don't really listen to the radio when I'm driving. I kind of like just driving in silence. And sometimes I'll think about like, where I was sort of 7 years ago, and then I'll be like, oh, that's where I was. Oh, that's what, oh.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh, that was so long ago. Why do I, and I think it's kind of like, I used to think it in a negative way, but I kind of like think about it as a constant reminder of where I don't want to be, and it influences the decisions that I make, that I do now. So.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Great.
Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you for thinking of me.
Always. Yeah. You got to, like I said, it's a really inspiring story, and even just your outlook on life for itself is such a good message for everyone listening. Is to stay positive, take one day at a time, and one foot in front of the other.
Who would have thought when we were 15 that we'd be sitting here doing this right now?
Not me.
Not me.
How funny is that, actually, when you think about it like that?
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks. Thank you so much for coming on. Everything that you're doing, it's amazing.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks, Al.